Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fitz on Fantasy. I'm Pat Fitzmaurice. Find me on Twitter at Fitz_FF. And you can find my weekly fantasy rankings at thefootballgirl.com. And joining me at this time is Mr. Ian Harditz of PFF. Ian is, without question, one of the most prolific producers of fantasy football content. He writes several articles every week, including a couple of very useful matchup columns and an exhaustive weekly examination of every NFL running back situation. Ian also hosts the PFF Fantasy Football Podcast, which you can hear 5 days a week. And he is, without a shadow of a doubt, one of the very best follows on fantasy Twitter. You can find him there at iHartitz, HARTITZ. Ian, I know you're a busy man. Thank you for carving out some time to join me.
Absolutely, Pat. Good to be on the pod, man. It's been, a pretty hectic 10 weeks. I was happy we didn't kind of get the overflowing crash of injuries this past Sunday that we kind of saw over the past few weeks. Always want these guys staying as healthy as possible. But you know what? We got those fantasy playoffs right around the corner. Plenty of stuff to break down and plenty of stuff to get ahead on.
Yeah, man, it was kind of a mercifully light week of injuries. I mean, the ugly Nick Boyle injury, although obviously not major fantasy implications there. The Andrew Whitworth thing, which maybe knocked some of the Rams down just a bit. But for the most part, no guys who are just going to torpedo fantasy teams, with their absence. So, you know, as I just mentioned, you are really one of the most essential follows on fantasy Twitter, and you're just really good at the medium, man. I think part of it is that you're versatile. You give people a lot of numbers, you give people some film, and you make it all fun. You've got a really good sense of humor. Ian Harditz brings the funny on Twitter. And I had Pat Doherty, your old Roto-World colleague, on the show a few weeks ago. Yeah, Pat's awesome, man. And he said that Twitter is like the perfect medium for him because he's always thought about things in tweet form. Is that what it's like for you at all? Like, do you feel Twitter is just naturally up your alley, or did you ever make like a concerted effort to sharpen your Twitter game?
Yeah, no, I'm with Pat there, and I've talked to him about that in person before, where I think we do kind of see things in a similar way, particularly when we're just kind of responding to, just kind of live tweeting along with the Sunday games, you know, just kind of doing one-offers and stuff like that, having a good time. But for me, man, Twitter was something that I used to just use as, you know, just for fun with my friends and tweeting a lot of, you know, dumb crap. I've had to dig through the old tweets, make sure I didn't say anything too stupid, but just kind of, you know, stream of conscious stuff over the years. It was all harmless, but, you know, once I got into just really working full time in this industry, you know, with Fantasy Labs, with what must have been, you know, 5 years ago or something like that. And, you know, when I started, it was kind of one of these things where I was like, okay, man, like this is your job now. We got to kind of start to spruce this thing up a little bit. And really the first kind of two things that I did that have kind of just shaped my entire Twitter presence since then was that one, you know, I got really tired. I mean, at that point, you know, I only had a couple hundred followers, most of whom were just my friends. And at that point, you know, I wasn't tweeting consistently about football, but I would go out with these articles that I'd work really hard on, man. You know, I was writing really as much as I did my first year in the industry as I am now. So it was a bunch of just time and spent these articles. And, you know, I saw the main account sending out the tweets, and I'm sure all the young fantasy football writers see the same thing, where we know that, you know, we're sending out some previews and this and that, that, let's be frank, you know, probably aren't getting that many views, but we're putting a lot of hard work into it. So I just didn't want to let that hard work go to waste. And I knew I was putting out good information, even if people weren't reading it. So I just started taking, pretty much as I was going through the process of, you know, coming up with the articles and then finishing them, you know, just making sure to tweet out like my favorite stats from that. I understand you can't always necessarily do that with certain paywalls and things of that nature, but more times than not, if you just credit whatever it is, the source you're referring to, you will be fine in that angle. So I think, you know, just going through my entire research process, I mean, probably 80% of the time I tweet, I am just writing an article and coming across this information as I'm going through it. And then with the videos, you know, that was another thing where I've always used video in my articles. And if you've ever tried to embed an MP4 in an article, that's usually way too big. You can only squeeze about 12, 15 seconds. So now, you know, it's one of those things where I think you can find about one clip of anybody anybody to support an argument. You know, you can say Patrick Mahomes, a terrible deep ball thrower, and throw and show him, you know, missing a wide open guy. But it's much harder to show, you know, 60 seconds, 90 seconds of the same kind of thing happening over and over again to prove your point. So that's what I prefer to do. And Twitter gives you that capability by embedding the video in the tweet. So, you know, it's always been, you know, about content for me. And it's Twitter's a real fun place. And, you know, I think just kind of bullshitting with my friends over the years, sending memes and GIFs back and forth has kind of helped with that whole angle. So compilation of a lot of things. I know it's a kind of a long rambly answer, but I just feel like, you know, to your point, yeah, I am kind of doing a bunch of different things on Twitter. They've all come together and it's a fun time, man. I'm just happy that all my followers out there, you know, keep the mentions so lighthearted. You know, there's always just joking going on. I understand there's a lot of Twitter that can be nasty all the time, but you know, we're all out here. We love football. We just want to talk about football. And at the end of the day, that's all, you know, that's what I've always loved. And that's what I want to continue to do. So, you know, people are just getting mad about this or that. Take a step back. It's freaking football. Chill out and let's just enjoy the day.
Yeah, you do have some fun with it. And even if you have cleaned it up a little bit since those days when you were bullshitting with your friends, like, you know, if you have put on the proverbial tie for your Twitter account, like at least it's a loosened tie. You are
100%.
You are definitely a fun follow. So, and I think one of the things you're known for on Twitter is helicopter guy. So you had this weekly tweet where you have this little stick man climbing out of a helicopter and down a rope ladder to make a player prediction. And my God, Ian, the helicopter guy was on fire with his predictions in 2019. I mean, you were just hitting those at such an amazing clip last year that it was almost just eerie. So first of all, how did you devise the idea for a helicopter guy? I mean, what was the inspiration?
Yeah, I mean, it was literally just week one of 2019. I was, you know, scrolling through TweetDeck that Sunday morning, before, you know, as actives and inactives rolling in, and the Los Angeles Chargers Twitter account sent out a helicopter guy dropping down advertising some deal. So I just copy-pasted the helicopter and said, you know, DeSean Jackson's going for 100-plus and 2 touchdowns, and he had that massive revenge game against Washington in week one of last season. So, yeah, man, they were rolling in hot and heavy in 2019, much, much less often this year. I managed to hit Justin Herbert, but other than that, I believe, but he lost 8 straight weeks. But look, it's just been one of these things where so many times people are just touting chalk and saying, oh, you know, the running back facing the 32nd ranked defense in a good spot. Like, yeah, we freaking know. So this is a situation where, you know, my come up was in with the Fantasy Labs guys, who I think, you know, are some of the smartest people in the entire industry. And I was kind of molded by the DFS side of things. So, you know, with daily fantasy sports, you really got to look at projected ownership and, you know, who is a good value relative to their costs and all sorts of different factors like that. So, you know, it was just got to the point where, hey, I hit a lot of these and that was great, man. But, you know, I am kind of easing off it for now. I'm not retiring it forever or anything, but just taking a little break because sheesh, dude, like just I have not caught more flack for anything than this one single prediction out with the helicopter. And that's part of the job. And if the worst thing I have to deal with is, you know, some people I'm never going to meet just give me some shit when I don't quite get the prediction right, that's fine. But man, you know, I really cared about this thing and I was becoming just the most stressful part of my week. Kind of just, you know, I could lose a couple hundred or a couple thousand, who knows, on DFS during a week. But, you know, if that helicopter went crashing down, I'd almost feel more pain from that happening. So it is what it is, you know, and it's hard to keep these, you know, sort of predictions going. I was absolutely surprised at how, you know, successful it was last season. But, you know, I've never been someone that's, you know, posting my screenshots of my winnings or, you know, taking active victory laps. It's always been, you know, one of these more just fun things to do. I like to take a stance on certain guys because, you know, we can all just sit around and, you know, just shake out a median projection and not really lean too heavily on one guy or another. Look, man, you know, if you're like me, we're talking about every single player, every single week. We are going to be wrong so many times. So the fact that, you know, it was turning into a situation where I just felt like my reputation was being a little too heavily tied to one player. I do so much work throughout the week. I just want to, you know, hope that people realize that, you know, these are educated and well thought out decisions that I'm trying to make.
Yeah, man, you like set that pole vault bar at like 23 feet for yourself right off the bat of some of those predictions, man. And like you said, it wasn't like all this chalk stuff. Like a lot of people do cherry pick the easy defensive matchups, you know, and sometimes you would lean into some like not obviously favorable matchups with some of these, some guys who were going up against pretty good defenses. And I would like, as hot as you were, I would go and I would look at where I had the guys ranked. When I saw your helicopter tweet, I'd be like, oh shit, where do I have Tyler Boyd? Am I high enough on Tyler? Like, if Ian's calling this, I got to get him up there a little bit in the rankings. Do you remember who the, you said it was DeSean Jackson. So that was quite a way to roll it out, man. You know, like his last fantasy relevant game ever, possibly.
Pretty much.
All right, let's talk about the Buccaneers for a few minutes, Ian. So they put on an offensive show against the Panthers in week 10, and yet they're still kind of a puzzle for fantasy purposes. I mean, it seemed like things were shifting Leonard Fournette's way in that backfield, and then came week 10. Ronald Jones had the big 98-yard touchdown run, of course, and then just generally effective all game. 23 carries for 192 yards. Played 10 more snaps than Fournette, had 14 more touches than Fournette. What is your take on the Rojo-Fournette dynamic?
Yeah, I'm so happy Rojo did have, you know, a solid overall game, and it wasn't just that one run, because nothing pisses me off more than when we see these analysts say, hey, you take away this guy's, you know, three biggest plays of the year, and all of a sudden he's not averaging that many yards. He made those plays. A lesser player wouldn't have. We cannot do that, people. Just like we can't say, you know, a quarterback had a great game if you remove the three picks. Goes both ways. You can't just remove the negative or positive plays. Got to look at the full picture. I understand if, you know, we're talking about a situation where the guy threw three picks that all hit his receivers in the chest, but that was not a situation for Rojo. But yeah, I mean, I don't think this backfield is necessarily sorted out. You know, I was just happy to see that Rojo, you know, he lost an early fumble and Bruce Arians went back to him. We've seen again and again over these past few years, it seems like the second Rojo makes a mistake, Arians has been willing to go with the next man up. So the fact he did continue to lean into him was good to see. I mean, it's not going to be the Fournette takeover we thought. It's just interesting though, man, because, you know, we see in Cleveland relatively high scoring offense, and they've just been enabling Hunt and Nick Chubb to kind of consistent RB2, if not RB1 production together. But with the Buccaneers, it's not that 50-50 split. They're almost leaning like 75-25 to one guy or another. So one guy is being rendered pretty much useless on a weekly basis, and the other guy is usually having a decent enough game. And because of that, you know, it's really tough to predict week to week. And I think it's going to limit, you know, our ability to rank Rojo too highly. Because again, if we've learned one thing about this backfield over the past 2 years, it's that it's never set in stone, even when you think it might be. So, hey, you know, kudos to Rojo and the fact that there is such a condensed 2-RB backfield now with Shady and Vaughn and those guys out of the picture. That's useful and we can feel a little bit more confident with Rojo, but I don't think Fournette's exactly going anywhere. You know, Rojo really wasn't having a good last few games, so kudos to him for popping off against the Panthers here, but not a situation again where I think he's going to be just the undisputed feature back moving forward. But it's okay, man, because this Buccaneers offense, they scored 46 points, and Brady, it was like almost a bad 341-yard and 3-touchdown performance. And look, I realize how, you know, insane that sounds. It is a big oxymoron. But I think when you just look at the performance and what happened, he had 2, if not 3, 50-yard touchdowns, one to Antonio Brown, one to Mike Evans, and one arguably to Gronk that with a better ball would have been 6. I mean, even the incompletions, we're seeing the sort of yardage that is available on the field for this high-flying offense. So I understand the Panthers aren't, you know, weren't the stiffest defensive tests or anything, but they've been playing some good ball really all year and keeping things close. They almost knocked off the Chiefs in Arrowhead 2 weeks ago, had a chance to win the game with a field goal. So for the Buccaneers to make it look easy and not even hit all their opportunities, really impressive to see. I do still think AB kind of emerges as the number one receiver of the group. I mean, we've just seen, you know, Evans only have 2 games all year with double-digit targets, and the way they're kind of featuring Brown on more of the design stuff, I think they want him to be kind of that alpha one. But, you know, Evans, he's getting fed in the red zone. Goblin, they're really starting to get him, you know, those low A-dot yak targets, and he looked healthier last week, and he has quite some time. So I think just like the Pittsburgh Steelers, even if we can't consistently fire up any of these receivers as top 10 options in their own right, they're all guys that you're going to want in your starting lineup more weeks than not. And I think we're going to see them in that, you know, 20 to 25 range at the lowest here moving forward.
Yeah, good point about both running backs' room for relevance in this offense. I mean, we know that the workhorse backs are so few and far between anyway. And, you know, this is one of those teams that's giving us two fantasy relevant guys. Like, even when it looked like maybe it was Fournette taking the lead, Rojo was still getting enough work to be fantasy relevant in weeks 8 and 9. And then, you know, it's not like Fournette was totally squeezed out in week 10. So you have Antonio Brown at the top of the Buccaneers wide receiver hierarchy. You think he is kind of ascending to that role where he's like maybe the most dependable guy week to week?
Yeah, it's just, you know, one of these things with Evans where we've, you know, after last week and Evans didn't get many targets, Bruce Arians just said he was open. Brady wasn't targeting him. And that's really been the case all season, man. There's a reason why we saw who was a freaking Jaden Mickens lead this team in targets the week before AP got there. They just haven't really leaned into Evans or Godwin as a true alpha wide receiver one that we know they can be and that we've seen in the past. But why would you take on all this bad PR and take all the risk that brings into AB, you know, coming onto your team if you weren't going to feature him as that guy? I think, you know, even though he is learning the offense, the reality that, you know, he had 5 targets last week when the team high was just 6. He had 8 this week, which was, you know, more than everyone except Evans. We've seen Mike Evans, you know, his targets go up and down throughout this entire season. For ABs in his first 2 games to really be more consistent than anyone else we've seen, I think speaks volumes. So he looks good out there, man. You know, only one, you know, caught 7 of 8 targets. It's just wild that him and Brady have kind of shown this early chemistry so high. I know there's an interception against the Saints and all that, but these guys have only played, you know, pretty much 2.5 football games together at this point, and we're already seeing some serious results. So I'm sure he'll find the end zone at some point. Again, they should have had a 55-yard touchdown on the first drive last week. Brady just couldn't put it on him. The deep ball hasn't been a problem for Brady all season. We are not looking at it, you know, a 2015 Peyton situation where Brady can't throw deep anymore. That's, you know, really only popped up this week. I think this offense, even if we don't have the same sort of high target share numbers that we would hope for, they have such high scoring upside that all these guys are going to be worth it.
Yeah, it is an offense that can spread a lot of love around and make a lot of different guys fantasy relevant. Let's move over to another NFC South team. It seems like a lot of fantasy managers were expecting Michael Thomas to just rip off the suit and tie and come out of the phone booth wearing his Superman cape as soon as he came back. But so far, 2 games, 7 catches, 78 yards, and just 2 catches for 27 yards in the win over the 49ers in Week 10. Do you think we're going to see the same sort of pyrotechnics that we saw from Thomas last year in 2020? Or do you think the circumstances are just different now and that we need to maybe lower expectations?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. You know, it's still going to be hard to make a rankings and leave Thomas outside of the top 12, but he will be, you know, out of my top 5, certainly here moving forward. You look at, you know, 2 weeks ago, he comes back. They faced the Buccaneers, who Carlton Davis locked up Michael Thomas in week 1, did another good job on him in that game. But, you know, the Saints were just up so much at freaking halftime that it didn't matter. And, you know, they were spreading the ball out throughout that game, so there was no need to force feed them. This last week, we actually saw the target share get condensed again. Only 23 pass attempts from the Saints on Sunday. Alvin Kamara had 8 targets. Michael Thomas had 7. Then we had Deontay Harris at 4, and nobody else had even more than 2. So we got back to seeing that offense that just force feeds Kamara and Michael Thomas. You know, just the overall target pie wasn't as big as we're used to seeing it. So I think, you know, Thomas is still going to be a guy that's going to be a fantasy wide receiver one, but clearly, you know, without Breeze in the lineup, I don't think we're going to see the same guy that, you know, went out there and broke Marvin Harrison's reception record. But I just want everyone to chill out on all the slant boy comments and, you know, trying to act like Michael Thomas just isn't this good of a wide receiver. I understand if you think Davante Adams, DeAndre Hopkins, and some other guys are better. I do as well. But, you know, even if you don't want to put Michael Thomas in that top 5, get out of here with any talk that this guy isn't a top 10 receiver. You know, the stuff he's done, not just last year, but the 2 previous seasons before, he's been anyone's idea of a high-end talent at the position ever since he came into the league. One of the most competitive guys out there. And, you know, it's just one of these situations where I feel like him kind of being a little more sensitive on Twitter than, you know, maybe he should, or, you know, whether, you know, he obviously doesn't care what anyone else thinks, nor should he. The guy's a freaking baller. But I just feel like, you know, his social media presence and just people kind of defending their team's wide receivers in the Julio versus Michael Thomas debate, like, we just want to keep saying this guy isn't the best wide receiver in the league, and that's fine. But don't get that twisted with him being outside the top 10, because, again, this guy's anyone's idea of a great NFL wide receiver.
Dude, not even sensitive. He went after Devontae Parker on Twitter with a vengeance in the offseason. Yeah. Man, maybe people are just standing up for poor Devontae.
Exactly. I understand that he's had like some of this coming to him with the way he's acted, but you know what? He's Michael freaking Thomas. So I'm, you know, Urban Meyer called him the most competitive player he ever coached at Ohio State. So if this is what it takes for him to continue to, you know, have that extra chip on his shoulder, even after he broke Marvin Harrison's freaking reception record, his 3rd season to the league, whatever works, man. Cause whatever Michael Thomas has been doing in his life, you know, it's obviously been paying high dividends so far.
Yeah, and that makes sense that he is still has to be regarded as a wide receiver one, but just maybe isn't the clear top dog anymore. And like that is kind of in line with what we've seen in the past. There were a couple wide receiver 6 finishes, and, you know, obviously he's not going to get there this year with the games missed, but not necessarily the best guy in the league, but still a clear wide receiver one. And, you know, bound to have some good weeks coming up here. Are you still a Jonathan Taylor optimist, Ian, or do you have concerns about his future?
Not really, man. And look, you know, going in this year, I was a lot lower on Taylor than most throughout the industry just because we had seen, you know, Frank Reich have a situation in 2015 coaching the Chargers where they drafted Melvin Gordon in the first round, proceeded to use Danny Woodhead, you know, ahead of him. But hey, it's a week-to-week league, man. We got to change our opinions, you know, as they come in. So after Marlon Mack went down in week one, I was fully on the Jonathan Taylor train. That was the concern. I did not see a scenario where Jordan Wilkins was going to be this involved, and I thought we would get a two-back offense. And to be honest, like, it really was trending towards it being a two-back offense at first. Then Wilkins got involved. Then he got hurt, and it seemed like coming out of their bye, maybe they would fully unleash Jonathan Taylor. That just hasn't been the case. So I just think that, you know, just like Michael Thomas not being the overall wide receiver one, you know, kind of that whole thing, like, we just can't let Jonathan Taylor not be in that top five back we were hoping for cloud the rest of our decision-making. I've seen, you know, some people just point towards Jordan Wilkins taking over this backfield, or, you know, Nyheim Hines, maybe it's going to be him all the time now. Honestly, Hines probably does deserve it more than anyone. He's looked pretty great all season long. But either way you look at it, this has been a consistently revolving three-back committee. And it's just unfortunate for Taylor that he really hasn't gotten, you know, just neutral game script all season. You go through every single one of these Colts games, man, and it's like they're either beating down opponents and up multiple scores and they're just kind of leaning on Wilkins in garbage time, or they're getting down multiple scores in the first half and they have to kind of go with Hines to be, you know, more of this pass-first offense. So either way, we're not seeing the same sort of consistent volume we'd hope for from Jonathan Taylor. The Colts, you know, this was PFF's number one ranked offensive line going into the year. They've, you know, underwhelmed just compared to their sky-high expectations. So, yeah, it's, you know, certainly a situation where maybe 2021 will yield better results, but at least for the rest of 2020, we're looking at a three-back committee, and that's just really hard to, you know, feel good about in fantasy land.
Yeah, that's just kind of the reality of the situation, I think. And like you said, you know, Frank Reich kind of told us it was going to be that way all along, I think, with like a Mac and Taylor split early on, and we didn't want to believe it. And what, you know, we just didn't see coming was that even after Mack got hurt, that it was still going to be a split and it was going to be Jordan Wilkins as the third man. So Mike Davis was pretty amazing for the first three games or so after Christian McCaffrey went down in week one. But just before CMC came back, and then again yesterday, Davis has been pretty ineffective. In his last five games, he's topped out at 66 rushing yards, 3.6 yards per carry over those five games, just 4.9 yards per catch. And he's now gone four straight games without a touchdown. And yet he's still basically dominating running back work for Carolina. I mean, Curtis Samuel is probably getting the most backfield snaps of anyone other than Davis there with CMC out. And the Panthers are going to be without McCaffrey for at least one more game, it appears. Do you think maybe Davis is just running out of gas after the way he was used so heavily earlier, probably more heavily than he's ever been used in his career?
Not necessarily. I thought he actually looked pretty good in week 10 with his opportunities. The problem was he just didn't have many opportunities with the ball, only 7 carries and 4 receptions. We have seen this offense, you know, when McCaffrey's out there, they are really trying to throw the ball just shorter and get him more involved in the passing game. And without him, we've seen them lean more on DJ Moore and Robbie Anderson. I mean, last year, Kyle Allen, I believe it was 54% of his targets to RBs were on his first read. This year, Teddy Bridgewater's at a much more reasonable 36% rate, which is, you know, right around league average. So, you know, I think it makes sense. Yeah, go to your wide receivers first and then come down to your running back. You know, we're going to see more efficient targets to your wide receivers just by virtue of them being further downfield most of the time. So, you know, running your entire passing game through your running back, I don't think is great for the overall passing game and that running back, because then teams, you know, can kind of tee off on them a little more. So I think that's why we actually saw a little more initial success out of this Panthers offense without McCaffrey, because they were just, you know, less predictable than they usually were. With Davis, I mean, yeah, to your point, he's still dominating the snap shares. And you look at these kind of games that he's had a rough time in, you know, bit blowout loss to the Buccaneers where he was out for a little bit with a wrist injury. Had a Falcons and Saints game where they were kind of in comeback mode and not able to control the clock. Now going to this game, a home date against the Detroit Lions, I think could be the sort of bounce back game that we're looking for, because we're not seeing anyone, you know, kind of step in and take away these snaps, rushes, and targets from him. It's just more been a kind of weird game script week after week that hasn't exactly allowed him to flourish. So, hey, you know, it's a Carolina Panthers offense. You know, anytime we have a team like this, that I believe, you know, 3-7 at this point, similar to Jaguars and some of the other, you know, bottom dwellers throughout the league, you know, we are going to see just a lower overall floor than someone in one of the league's more high-scoring offenses. But I still think, you know, it's going to be hard to rank 12 running backs ahead of Mike Davis, considering the guy rarely leaves the field.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, the great matchup with Detroit. And maybe in his defense, well, first of all, as you mentioned, he did briefly leave with the hand injury, and game script obviously did not really go his way this past week against the Buccaneers. Plus, the Buccaneers have obviously one of the best run defenses in the league. So, yeah, definitely too early to give up on him. I agree with you on that. So we had a lot of bad weather games in week 10, just ridiculously gusty winds in Cleveland for the second time this season. High winds in Green Bay too, somewhat windy in the Giants and Steelers games, and then windy, rainy conditions in New England on Sunday night. I mean, my God, it looked like they were playing the final 2 minutes of that game underneath a waterfall. I tend to be kind of a fade the weather guy, Ian, but do you have a general philosophy on weather effects, the degree to which they affect your rankings and your own lineups, and just – like, are there certain thresholds of wind or rain where you start to really downgrade guys?
I do lean towards, you know, the group that wind is definitely more important than rain. You know, and anytime we kind of see that get over 15, once we start getting that, you know, 20 mile per hour mark, that's about when I start to pay attention. But for me, I use it as more of a tiebreaker. I'm kind of with you where, you know, I'm not going to make these overarching lineup decisions just because of the weather. To your point, yeah, it was a freaking monsoon in New England last night, and Lamar Jackson had his most productive passing game since week one. So, you know, I think game script and just, you know, just how offenses are as a whole, those types of things are going to make, you know, more of an impact on, I think, how the game plays out than weather. Yes, we see games, you know, just completely tanked by weather, you know, such as this Browns game. They had another one against the Raiders a few weeks ago. That was a similar thing. But then we also see the Packers, you know, the Steelers really not have an issue with it at all. So I think, you know, it's one of those things that we tend to overthink it more times than not. You should pay attention to it. It's important, you know, particularly I think in the gambling world when you're looking at some of these over-unders and you see them just falling, you know, 7 points sometimes in the middle of the week as weather comes in. So it's really important to be on top of it for, you know, any of you out there trying to chase a hot spread or anything like that. But in fantasy land, you know, it's certainly worthy of downgrading someone. But, you know, I get some start sick questions on Sunday where it's like, do you want to play his top 15 wide receiver in a bad weather game or this guy, you know, ranked outside the top 30? And it's like, no, start your studs. You know, it's matchups, weathers. You know, we have 7 days usually to kind of research, prepare for the next week's matchup. And I think these are sort of things we tend to overweight a little bit, put a little too much stock into. So again, it's always good to be aware of all the factors going into it, but don't let one thing like weather, you know, persuade your entire decision-making process.
Yeah, and you get a lot of those, man. I mean, like, you know, guys wanting to start Jalen Guyton over Jarvis Landry or something, and it might work out or whatever, but, you know, it's just not the right percentage play unless we're talking about, like, you know, tornadoes going on during the game. So, Ian, it's my understanding that you were a high school running back. Is that true?
I played both ways. I was primarily linebacker, but I got some carries my junior year. That was a fun time.
Oh, nice. What high school and what town?
I'm from Dublin, Ohio. Played for Dublin Jerome. You know, I never got to play against Dublin Coffin. They're the more famous one. They produced Brady Quinn, Jake Stoneburner, and a couple other NFL guys over the years. But, you know, Jerome, just a D2 school. But the Celtics, we play hard, and, you know, it's been a fun time. I'm actually back close to home now. I'm in Columbus, about 30 minutes away. But I got a lot of respect for my former and current Celtics players out there.
Oh, nice, man. So you are from really a football-crazed part of the country. I mean, in Ohio, it's nothing else. Was this
football capital of the world, man?
Yeah, of course. Were your parents, like, did they have a football in your crib, basically?
Pretty much, man. My parents have been, particularly my mom, just diehard Dallas Cowboys fans my entire life. So, you know, it's one of those things where the more I've been in the just kind of full-time, you know, making this my job, certainly, you know, just been siding a little bit more with players than I think, you know, focusing on one team. But I have, you know, just always been, you know, just around the game of football. And growing up, I mean, it was just always what I love more than anything. I remember I mailed a Bill Belichick and Bill Parcells some plays when I was like 8 or 9 years old. And luckily the PR departments with the Patriots and Cowboys were kind enough to send me back a signed photo and, you know, appreciate the support. So I'm not quite sure the players ever made it into the game plan, but it was, you know, enough to kind of spark my interest in the sport, you know, and here we are now.
Oh, that's awesome, man. Were you ever interested in coaching at some level?
Yeah, I'd still want to be honest. I don't really want to do college or try to pursue anything that high end. I just think at that point, you know, a lot of it becomes recruiting and the grind. And I just don't know if I have that in me at this point. But, you know, middle school, high school, just anything to kind of just be a defensive assistant maybe and try to, you know, draw up some schemes to help help make some high schooler out there's life a living hell when they got to come up against that defense. So I think that'd be awesome. And, you know, it would be a good way of giving back. Right now, it's a situation where, you know, I've just been grinding a little too much during the season, and obviously, you know, our busiest work stretch coincides with when I would be trying to coach, but something I definitely have my eye on in the future, you know, once I'm hopefully able to become a little bit more efficient with my you know, in-season process and open up some more time for myself.
So I know it's probably not as much of a concern in places like Ohio, Pennsylvania, Texas, Florida, like some of the truly football mad parts of the country, but like in other parts of the country, you know, parents have this lingering concern about whether they should let their kids play, you know, the concussion worries, just other physical trauma. Any like lingering physical effects for you from your football days, like knee pain or anything like that?
I got a couple crooked fingers still, but I got pretty lucky with, you know, not experiencing any severe lower body injuries. I did get a couple, you know, confirmed concussions and a couple more where, you know, you don't really say much because that was just kind of mindset back then. But, you know, it is something where, you know, I see some of this news and stuff, and it is concerning to think about the future potentially. But I do see, you know, such a difference in the way the game is played now versus even 10, 15 years ago. You know, it used to be a high pass over the middle and that receiver is getting his head taken off. Now, if that happens, you know, and even if it happens and just looks bad, even though it isn't bad, usually it's 15 yards. If not, you know, the guy's being pulled from the game. So because of that, I think it's become a better product and just an overall safer one. But no, I mean, I wouldn't trade it for the world. You know, and maybe my opinion will change, you know, when I'm 60 or 70 or something. You know, I can't predict the future and how I'll feel then. But at least for right now, you know, just the greatest moments and memories of my life. And I think some of the best lessons all came from being, you know, involved in football and on the team. So I'm not saying those aren't, you know, things you can learn from playing a different sport. But I think overall, you know, just trying to be, you know, hey, if you want to play basketball or baseball instead because you're worried about it, that's fine. But to me, you know, I haven't even had a bigger high in my life than just making great plays out there on the football field. And I think, you know, that's something I would never want to hold my kid or anyone else's kid back from doing that. There's something there in themselves. You know, we never force anyone to do it, obviously. But I just think, you know, the benefits far outweigh the, you know, cost that at least I've seen at this point.
Yeah. And you make a really good point about the way the game is played and having changed, you know, from the days when it used to be these highlight films, the NFL would actually market their most violent hits and all this stuff. And, you know, when they kind of had the philosophical change on that and started worrying more about protecting their players, and they did change the way the game was officiated. And of course, like at first, everyone was up in arms that these things were getting flagged. And, you know, why don't you put the quarterback in a skirt and all those sorts of comments. But it actually has changed the way, like it did take, got enough personal fouls flagged early on. And suddenly people are starting to get more conscious of the way they handle things when a guy's about to go out of bounds or a quarterback starts to slide. You don't see as many guys, you know, going for the kill shots anymore. So I think you're totally right about that. All right, one more non-fantasy question for you, Ian. Why did Derek Carr block you on Twitter?
I deserved it. That's why I was, you know, look, I've been heavy in the meme and, you know, GIF game over the years. And, you know, anytime I could find something that would kind of show someone panicking and throwing something in a situation, I would usually try to relate that to Derek Carr, you know, being under pressure, or just taking the first check down. Because the infuriating thing with Derek Carr over the years has been, this is a guy with fantastic arm talent. They've usually had, you know, one of the league's more expensive offensive lines. We've seen, you know, Cooper and Crabtree. I'm not saying he's had the best weapons throughout his career, but never, you know, super depleted like the, you know, Ravens this year or anything like that. So, but hey, man, you know, as I've been saying, we got to change our opinions as things come along. I am a Derek Carr stan this year. If you people have been listening to PFF Fantasy Football Podcast, I've been giving this dude props really ever since, you know, the first month of the season, particularly since week five, because since Henry Ruggs has returned in week five, Derek Carr has an average target depth of 9.2 yards. That's tied for ninth among 39 QBs with at least 25 dropbacks in that sample. Derek Carr has been throwing downfield more than Josh Allen since week five. It's absolutely wild. He's been making some great plays. You know, people are going to look at his game from Sunday and say, oh, you know, 165 scoreless yards. You know, he didn't mean anything in that win. He hit Darren Waller in the chest on a would-be 55-yard touchdown, hit Aguilar in the hands on a potential red zone touchdown, and had another deep ball of Ruggs that went right through his hands. So truly, Derek Carr, in my opinion, is playing the best football of his career. You know, I know he had that kind of MVP campaign in 2016, but that was more due to the wins and losses. I think you look at the underlying metrics, and he's been more of an average QB. So it's wild this has happened. You know, adding Ruggs, obviously he hasn't, you know, had huge gains himself, but I think having, you know, that extra field stretching dimension has been great for the offense. And, you know, credit to Carr for kind of taking this Ryan Tannehill seventh year leap when it didn't really seem like we were going to see a new guy out there. So yeah, man, you know, we'll see if I can ever get unblocked by Carr through some of these nice things I've been saying. But, you know, I fully understand why he did it. And I in no way, shape, or form think he was out of line by doing so.
It's funny, though. You're right about that. It almost goes back to that one game. And I can't remember the exact final line for Henry Ruggs, but he had like two catches for 116 yards and a touchdown.
Against the Chiefs. 70-yarder.
Yep. But, you know, yeah. And those couple of deep out, that was the upset over the Chiefs. And, you know, just like that planted the seed in Derek Carr's head, it almost seems like. Like, hey, throw it downfield and take your shots with a fast guy. Like, good things can happen sometimes. So
he's always been good at it. He just hasn't done it with any sort of frequency. And now we're seeing him get that frequency up. And lo and behold, the Raiders offense is starting to look pretty darn good. So it's not even like, look, Drew Brees and stuff. We've been talking about his deep ball. A lot of the best quarterbacks in the league don't throw downfield all the time, but you got to at least make the defense, you know, respect it. And then that makes all those, you know, checkdowns and intermediate routes to Darren Waller all that much easier. So just doing it a little bit and not being known as the guy that just refuses to throw downfield can open up your entire offense.
Right. And as you mentioned, there might even be hope for Alex Smith, right? I mean, he started to do it a little more starting yesterday.
Oh, it was fantastic, man. Look, I went on a couple of rants about him last week just because, look, comeback player of the year, amazing story. We all get that. But in fantasy land, we got to look at the production. And, you know, okay, he threw for over 300 yards in week nine, but he had an average target depth of 3.5 yards, man. That was the single lowest mark of any quarterback in any week this entire season. And he threw three picks throughout it. So, you know, he had the touchdown to McLaurin that probably should have been picked and was a hospital ball to begin with. It was just Terry's greatness that made it happen. So, really, I thought he was just playing terrible ball. But this week, you know, did not start off well. J.D. McKissic had freaking like 11 targets by halftime. Offense had 3 points. They were in a major hole. Then there's this 4th and 13 where they, you know, had to go for it. You know, they were on like the 14-yard line or something. Smith has to throw it on field. He throws a rocket, picks it up. It seemed like a freaking flip switch in his head after that, man, because we were seeing him go downfield to McLaurin, get Cam Sims involved. Isaiah Wright was making plays. I mean, you know, Antonio Gibson still playing too far much behind J.D. McKissic, but at least in this one, man, Alex Smith – once he hit that 4th and 13, truly saw him, you know, start to go downfield, and he led him back. So he had three big time throws, you know, one of these advanced metrics that PFF is, you know, grading and keeping track of. Three big time throws last week, only had one combined in his two previous appearances. So, you know, sometimes the box scores can be deceiving, but make no mistake about it. I realize that, you know, the 55 pass attempts helped Alex Smith get all those yards and everything. I'm not saying he's going to be, you know, the super fancy viable quarterback, but at a minimum, the, you know, the Washington offense in the second half against the Lions certainly looked like a you know, real life version of an offense, which has been hard to come by for them for the most part this year.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the McKissic thing. I mean, that's like, you know, he's a perfectly fine third down back or whatever, but they've got this extraordinary talent in Antonio Gibson, who I think everyone wants to see as much of as possible. And, you know, they're basically running out Gibson or McKissic for half the snaps in that offense. And it's kind of frustrating. You know, even though Gibson still is producing and, you know, McKissic himself, I guess, has become sort of fantasy relevant, at least in all PPR formats. And I don't know, I guess we fantasy analysts like to sometimes act as if we're kind of above the fray as far as getting upset about usage. But I don't know, is there any situation for you this year where the usage or non-usage of a guy is just kind of driven you up the wall with your own teams?
No, it's this exact situation, man. It's because, like, you know, with Gibson coming out this year, the concern. Yeah, man, exactly. Because the thing with Gibson, you know, being this collegiate wide receiver, we thought that, okay, let's get this, you know, pass down role in the offense, and we'll probably have to deal with Peyton Barber or Bryce Love taking a lot of the early down work. That happened in week one, but Gibson has been the lead early down back ever since week two. Barber might get a snap or two per game, but it really has been the Gibson show. And we thought, okay, you know, now could we be seeing the freaking Christian McCaffrey role for Antonio Gibson? Because he's got McCaffrey's old coach, and then he had his old quarterback when Kyle Allen went under center. But unfortunately, man, they just continue to force feed McKissick. And, you know, some people have been saying, oh, with Alex Smith out there, they need McKissick to protect him and all that. McKissick has not pass blocked for more than five snaps in any game this season. So I understand that, you know, he goes out there and maybe chips some guys and he has a better understanding of the offense. But I haven't checked the updated numbers. I'm sure they're even more outrageous. But going into week 10, McKissick had 24 targets lined up in the slot or out wide. So not even in the backfield. And, you know, Alvin Kamara was the second most targeted back in those situations, all the way down at 16. So, like, the fact they've been feeding McKissick just these targets that he hasn't been doing a better job with than Gibson in the first place, I just don't understand it, man, because it'd be one thing if McKissick was just making his, you know, the most out of these opportunities, but we see it almost kind of pull back this offense with them, you know, just consistently feeding this dude's the freaking Alvin Kamara type workload. So, hey, if McKissick was balling out, we'd be pumped about it. We would want to roster him, but that really hasn't been the case. Gibson's looked like the best running back all year. All the advanced stats say he's been their best running back all year, and you know, it's only McKissick that's holding him back from getting the sort of workload that would make him a weekly fantasy RB1. So yeah, I mean, to your point, I mean, both these guys haven't been getting enough volume to kind of be settling in to that, you know, top 25 range, but it's just kind of what could be for Antonio Gibson that has made this whole situation all the more frustrating.
Yeah, can you imagine the disbelief we would have had if we would have been told in late August that by week 10 Antonio Gibson was going to have a clear majority of early down work but was not going to be the primary passing down back? I mean, we would have
no sense, man.
Yeah, apoplectic when someone would have told us that. But funny how these things go during the course of the season. Ian, is Carson Wentz a good quarterback?
Yeah, because I don't think we see bad quarterbacks play at the level he did in 2017 for even like a couple weeks. And for him to have sustained that for, I think it was what, 13 or 14 games before he got hurt. I mean, we just don't see quarterbacks play at that high of a level and just completely fall off. But man, he has not been a good quarterback in the year 2020. I will say that. And it's been up and down. We've seen flashes, but you know, unfortunately in the first couple weeks of the year when everyone was healthy, Wentz was playing really bad. Then he started to turn it up a little bit for the middle part when everyone got hurt. Now a lot of guys are getting healthy again, but we're not seeing, you know, that consistently good version of Wentz come back. So, you know, he's one of these guys where we see him, you know, just continuing to kind of battle, I think, that urge to go off script, make something happen on his own, you know, try to make up for kind of a season of disappointment in one play, but just hasn't been going his way. And, you know, now with the inconsistency with the teammates around him, offensive lines, you know, kind of been the worst version of itself, I think, during Wentz's tenure there, at least going back to his rookie year. So, you know, look, he's had opportunities to make a lot more plays than he has, but it also hasn't been the most ideal situation around him. So, you know, I certainly expected more out of Wentz this year. So it's been disappointing to see that, but I still think it's a little bit early to just rule him out as in terms of just, you know, someone that doesn't have a chance to succeed at the NFL level, because again, I just don't think we see quarterbacks play as well as he has shown he can play in the past, not, you know, be able to do even a little bit moving forward. But he has been pretty awful this year, I will admit.
Yeah, he has been such a hard guy to peg, because it seemed like just when things should have been at their lowest point for him, when the injuries to his pass catchers had just built to a crescendo, and it was basically just Travis Fulgham out there, he had some of his best weeks of the season, basically because he was scrambling around and running in touchdowns. And, you know, now he's got Rager back. He's got Alshon Jeffrey back. He's got Miles Sanders back. And, you know, Goddard's healthy. And, you know, he goes out there and lays the egg against the Giants just when you think he's ready to roll. And it's interesting, man, because he's got such an easy playoff schedule coming up. But he's kind of a hard guy to trust with the way things have gone for him. All right, Ian, let's finish up with a little game of is he fantasy relevant? All right, so I'll throw out a few names of guys who have sort of bubbled up here in the last week or two, and you tell me whether you think these guys can be viable options for the final 6 weeks of the fantasy season. All right, ready? Salvon Ahmed.
I'm going to go with no. He's looked fine over the past 2 weeks, and the usage was obviously great on this past one, over 70% snaps and, you know, over 20 combined carries and targets. But seems like Matt Breida is, you know, right on the cusp of coming back, and he could easily just take over this offense. I mean, he's been their backup all season long. We don't know what this committee looks like when Breida is healthy. And Myles Gaskin, you know, I haven't seen an update recently, but to my knowledge, it didn't seem like, you know, his IR trip was going to be one that, you know, leaves him out for the rest of the season. So I believe he's already spent 2 weeks on. This will be the third, you know, one of these situations where, hey, you know, if Breida still comes in banged up, or if they even just use him as the pass down back when he comes back, Achmed's going to have some sort of value to that extent. But, you know, with Gaskin coming back soon, Achmed isn't someone that, you know, I'm looking to exactly blow the, you know, rest of my fab on, just because I think, you know, we're looking at probably more likely than not only one more maybe usable week.
Yeah. Do you think when Gaskin does come back that Gaskin goes back to that workhorse role, or do you think now it might be a little bit more of the supporting cast getting involved?
It could be a little more supporting cast. I mean, he truly was playing like an every down role. The good news for everyone involved is, you know, right before we started recording this podcast, Jordan Howard got released. So, you know, he was kind of the annoying vulture out there that was just, you know, taking the touchdowns from everybody when he was active. So the fact he's out help matters, but, you know, Breida's going to be getting some of the pass down work. If Achmed continues to play well, you know, I agree with you. I think he could carve out a little bit of a role, but I still think it'll be the Gaskin show more weeks than not.
How about Marquez Valdez-Scantling?
He's just a boomer bust wide receiver, man. He has been all year. He's got one of the highest average target depths in the league. I mean, it's kind of like what Michael Gallup was with the Cowboys earlier this year. I think Gallup's a better overall player. But, you know, when you have this just outside receiver where the overwhelming majority of their targets are just on these deep balls down the sideline, we're going to see, you know, a very wide range of outcomes on the good side, like we've seen with Marquez Valdez-Scantling over the past 2 weeks. And then on the downside, which was, you know, pretty much the previous 5 or 6 weeks before that. So, you know, we've seen the big games, and that's great. There's a lot of guys out there that don't have those big games in their range of outcomes, but, you know, just realize we could have a, you know, plenty of busts coming up as we have seen throughout the year. So I don't think we're about to see, you know, any sort of consistency from him, but hey, you know, there's worse guys to have than someone that can pop off for the big weeks. I would note that Alan Lazard was very close to returning this past week, and I think once he is back in the picture, it's not going to completely render MVS as irrelevant or anything like that, but I do think Lazard will be kind of the number two wide receiver to own in Green Bay.
Yeah, considering the difficulty MVS has catching perfectly thrown balls with no weather conditions whatsoever, I was pretty surprised to see him go off when the wind was blowing 25 miles an hour in Green Bay yesterday. Devontae Booker.
Yeah, so I think with Booker, the one thing that could help him out at least this week, maybe beyond, is that Jalen Richard suffered a chest injury in that game yesterday. So if he's out and they kind of, you know, give Booker all the reps that both he and Richard were getting, now we're looking at potentially 8 to 12 combined carries and targets per game. And, you know, there's worse options than someone that has that sort of workload in a Raiders offense that, you know, again, has been putting up points this year more weeks than not. So it's still a Josh Jacobs show. I don't think Booker's going to be scoring, you know, 2 touchdowns per week or anything like that here moving forward. But he would be the guy to own for sure. If Jacobs goes down with an injury, we saw last year, you know, DeAndre Washington work ahead of Jalen Richard in that situation. So Booker, I don't think he's someone that, you know, is going to give you all that much standalone value. You're not going to feel good about starting him as long as Josh Jacobs is active, but he's definitely a good guy to, you know, have on the bench if you're in, you know, a 12 team or deeper league.
Yeah, agree. And the Raiders aren't going to get 40 carries every week like they did against Denver in week 10, but he is at least in the essential handcuff category now, I think. Jakeem Grant.
Yeah, he probably has the best chance, you know, of these four guys that we've gone over to kind of maintain some consistent value. I mean, Cliff Kingsbury, I know he's biased because he coached Jakeem Grant at Texas Tech, but, you know, he called him one of the most explosive weapons in the NFL, and I think we have kind of seen that out of him before stretches over the years. So, you know, small guy, pint-sized speedster, he's kind of battled some injuries over the years. But, you know, coming into this game, the question was what's going to happen with Preston Williams out of the picture, and the answer was Jakeem Grant worked as, you know, the offense's number two overall pass game option. So it's going to be Devontae Parker more weeks than not. You know, even if Grant did finish with more targets than Parker in this one, I don't think that's going to be the case moving forward. But hey, he's going to be a number two guy in this offense. Now, the problem is this offense with Tua under center, you know, they're more than content to try to win games with their defense and not asking Tua too much through the air. So I don't think, you know, you really want to start either Grant or Parker, you know, with much consistency. But just in terms of, you know, who can actually kind of sustain this sort of high-end snap share moving forward, I think Grant will at a minimum be on the field, you know, more pass plays than not for the Dolphins, even if we don't see as many pass plays as we probably want, you know, as people that might be rostering their wide receivers.
Ian, let me sneak one last guy in here, Kalen Ballage.
No, I think, you know, it was weird to see Troy Maine Pope not play, but Lodge has been fine. He's been getting a lot of carries, but, you know, Justin Jackson, I believe he went on, IR, but he's someone that isn't necessarily going to miss the rest of the year. Austin Eckler sending out videos on his Twitter now, you know, about him starting to look spry. So he should be back, hopefully, fingers crossed, knocking on wood, before too long. And Joshua Kelly's still there too, getting his, you know, handful of, runs. So now Caleb Lodge, good story. You know, it's great to see another guy, you know, escape the shackles of Adam Gase and find some level of fantasy relevance. But I just think that, you know, the one thing we've kind of seen in this Chargers backfield without Austin Eckler is that it's an incredibly fluid situation that can change week to week. So Balaj, another one of those guys like Ahmed, where, hey, maybe in the near future, this next week or two, we see him kind of maintain this role. And in that case, okay, he'll be a top 24 option probably at the position just based on volume alone. But, you know, looking up to week 16, I think Balaj, you know, has one, best case, two more weeks in him tops.
Yeah, I don't think people are going to be rolling him out for playoff games, but maybe against the Jets this week, there are going to be some people tempted to throw him into lineups. Ian, you are the man. That's Ian Harditz, ladies and gentlemen. Be sure to check out all of his great content at PFF.com. It's well worth the subscription. And be sure to listen to him on the PFF Fantasy Football Podcast. And of course, go find him on Twitter at iHarditz. Thanks again, Ian.
Appreciate you, man. Best of luck in week 11 and beyond, everyone.
All right. That is going to do it for this week. Let me once again thank my esteemed guest, Ian Harditz of PFF. Find him on Twitter at iHarditz. My wonderful, faithful producer is Ireland's favorite son, Calm Kelly. Find him on Twitter at Overtime Ireland. My fabulous content partner is Melissa Jacobs, the owner and operator of thefootballgirl.com. Find her on Twitter at thefootballgirl. A special thanks to the great Milwaukee ska band International Jet Set for the music. And of course, my thanks to all of you for listening. Be sure to come back next week when I will be joined by another great guest. And meanwhile, good luck to all of you in week 11. We are heading into the home stretch. Let's finish strong, people. Talk to you again next week. I got a hand.